what it says to me, because one thing people often ask is like, okay, if we have this central governor that's holding us back for our own good, isn't that sort of dangerous to push past it? Aren't we going to push ourselves to death? And I would say it's not that there's zero danger. There are some situations, especially in like hot weather, if you're pushing yourself really hard in hot weather, the brain's sort of calculations don't seem to be as reliable as they could be, and sometimes people get in serious trouble and get heat stroke. But for the most part, we're a long way from true physical limits, and it's very, very hard to, you know, if you learn to push a little farther, to hold, just kind of hold your finger in the candle flame a little bit longer, you're not getting anywhere near true physical limits. You're just pushing a little closer.
That's Alex Hutchinson, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is my show. Around here, we go long form. I bring fascinating guests to you and we explore uncertainty across all domains and all walks of life because, let's face it, the only certainty in this world is uncertainty. But before we begin, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. And as a listener to All Things Risk, you can get a free 30-day trial, which includes a free audiobook that is yours to keep no matter what. To take advantage of this, simply go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you are in the US. And if you are in the UK, click on the link in the show notes. All right, let's get into it. And we'll do that by asking a simple question, and that is, what are our physical and mental limits? Because today's episode is all about that, and it's not an easy question to answer. Those limits, as you'll hear, are elastic, and they are about the body and they are about the mind. My guest is Alex Hutchinson. Alex is an award-winning journalist and author. He's a regular columnist for Outside Magazine. He's got a column called Sweat Science, and he recently wrote an amazing book about human endurance. It's called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. This is a book that, among other things, explores the relationship between mind and body in athletic performance. And I came away from reading it not only understanding far more about the research into athletic performance, but with a far greater appreciation for the interaction between mind and body than I ever had before. And when we think about uncertainty, one of the biggest uncertainties we have is in knowing the limits to our physical performance as humans and how the limits we have may be set by our own minds. This was an amazing conversation, and I'm so grateful that Alex joined me to record the episode. We covered loads of great stuff, including the background to Alex's book, Endure, in which he has a very interesting story, the role of perceived effort, pacing, belief, oxygen and breath, mental fatigue, and tons more. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Alex Hutchinson. Welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. I'm super excited about having you on the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Ben. I'm excited to have this conversation.
So there is a bit of an endurance theme throughout my podcast, and I loved your book. It's so interesting, and I want to get into all of that. But before we dive into Endure, it would be great if you gave a little bit of a background to my listeners around, you know, who you are and the type of work that you've done and all of that good stuff.
Sure. Yeah. I guess probably the best way to describe me right now is that I'm a science journalist who focuses on the science of endurance and fitness and health and things like that. I write a column for Outside Magazine called Sweat Science, where it basically just involves kind of trolling through the peer-reviewed literature, and my sort of my shtick or my approach is that I'm not really interested in calling up experts and hearing what they think. Not that that's not a valuable source of information, but I'm my corner of the world is that I look at what sort of evidence we have for whether it's, you know, is going for a hike in nature good for your mental health, or is an ice bath good for your recovery, or how, you know, what sorts of things enhance performance. So that's been my focus as a journalist for the last 10 years or so, I would say. My background, I just as sort of to zoom out a little bit, is that I started as a physicist. I did a PhD in physics and worked as a postdoctoral physicist for a few years, and then I was also a runner, like you, I guess. And I competed for the Canadian national team for a number of years.
You weren't a runner like me then.
it's the fundamental challenge is the same for all of us,
right?
So running and science are my two sort of big formative influences, and in my late 20s, I decided it might be fun to be a journalist, and that was, 15 years ago, and that's where I'm at these days.
Cool. I want to talk a little bit about the book Endure that you wrote, and I want to get back to a few of the things that you actually just mentioned as well, but we'll put a pin in things like, you know, recovery and walks in nature and stuff like that. But I want to talk about, or want you to give us the origin story of this book, Endure, and what led you to writing it.
Well, there are, as with all big projects, there are probably 15 different origin stories. That, like, you know, there's different things that come together. That you know, my own athletic background is one of them. That's maybe worth maybe even starting with some of the one of the sort of formative experiences in my life that led me down this road. There's sort of proximate causes and ultimate causes and all that. So at risk of you know, rambling in a long anecdote, let me tell you a story about a race that I ran back in 1996 when I was in university, which I think will tell you a lot about where my fascination with this topic comes from and what it means to me. So as a university student, my goal in life was to break 4 minutes for the 1500 meters, which is, it's a little bit shorter than a mile, right? So it's about 17 seconds shorter than a mile. So it's kind of a poor man's 4 minute mile barrier. And it was a barrier that I initially thought would be very easy to break. I ran 4:02 in my second year of running in high school. But then I really hit a plateau, and for four straight years, I ran either 4:01 or 4:02. So in terms of the idea of pushing physical limits, I felt like I was, you know, approaching the borders of what my body was capable of. I thought I could run 3:59, and that's what I wanted to do, but I figured there wouldn't be much beyond that. And what happened to me in a very sort of insignificant race one year in my third year of university is that I went out running this race, and in track races, you have someone standing at the start line calling out splits every lap so you know how fast you're going. And this was an indoor race, so it was 200 meter track. And I came through the first lap, and the timekeeper called out 27 seconds. And for any, you know, 1500 meter runners out there, they'll know that 27 seconds is way, way, way too fast for a 4 minute 1500. So my response was the sort of mix between, you know, panic and confusion, because it actually felt better than I would have expected a 27 second 200 to feel like. And so I kept going, and I tried to sort of ease up a little bit, and came through the second lap, and the timekeeper called out 57 seconds, which is still way, way, way too fast, but still felt surprisingly good. And when the same thing happened after the third lap, it was one of those moments where I was just thinking, I don't know what's happening, but this is, you know, something amazing is happening, and don't waste this opportunity. Just stop calculating, stop worrying, stop thinking about whether this is the right or the wrong thing to do. Just go, put your head down and run. And I did that, and I ended up crossing the finish line in 3:52.4, which was a 9 second personal best after four years of being stuck in the same place. And there's a lot, you know, I could ramble on about this story for another hour, but for one thing, I never ever struggled to break 4 minutes again after that. What it turned out had happened when, you know, I was talking to my teammates after the race and saying, gosh, you know, did you see how fast I started? Wow, that was crazy. Hey, and one of my friends had taken my splits for me so that I could put them in my training log. And he said, no, it wasn't that fast. Your first lap was 30 or 31 seconds. and, you know, second lap was 60. So I still don't know why it happened, but the timekeeper was giving me the wrong splits. He might have probably missed the start and started his watch 3 seconds late or something. And he basically fooled me into thinking I was having the greatest day of my life. And so I did. But that really altered my my sort of understanding of what it means to be pushing to your limits. And you know, after that, as a runner, I could never be sort of confident that when I finished a race and felt like I'd pushed as hard as I could, that I really had. And it's, I think, ultimately what seeded my interest when I became a journalist and I started writing about, you know, combining my interest in science and sport and writing about the science of sport. The fundamental question that I was interested in attacking, and this is about 10 years ago, was what defines our limits? When you're pushing as hard as you can, what is the variable that we're talking about that is maxed out? And that started a sort of discovery process and a sort of getting familiar with what was going on in the scientific literature in this area that sort of led to the book and to the general conclusion that in most cases, when we think about physical limits, when we feel like we're experiencing physical limits, that reflects something that's going on in our brains, not in our muscles or our hearts.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And the thing that I took away from reading the book was, it's kind of hard to tell where the mind ends and the body begins. They're just extensions of one another. At least that's what I took away from it.
There's a quote in the book from one of the researchers who was you know, studying exactly these questions back in the 1960s, and in this academic paper from like 1961, and you know, it's a great paper. So it's a paper where, among other things, to try and explore the nature of limits, they were having people do like maximum muscle contractions, and they had one of the researchers sneak up behind their subjects and fire a gun in their ear, like not with bullets, but fire a blank pistol in their ear to scare the crap out of them, and found that, hey, this, you know, this enhances their maximum muscle strength by 9% or whatever it is. But anyway, in that paper, he has this sentence saying, well, of course, psychology is nothing but a special case of brain physiology. And that's an important point. So when, you know, in a sense, when we start talking about, well, where does the, you know, is it the body or the mind that is reaching its limits? Well, it's all one thing. So we're foolish to imagine we could find a border between the body and the mind. They're closely interwoven. But of course, it's still useful to think about these things, because it's a useful sort of dichotomy, even if it's ultimately always a fake one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to dive into that a little bit more, particularly the sections in your book around the mind and the muscle and the... Maybe if we could start with this central governor theory that is, I suppose, popular and controversial in running circles, but perhaps it might be interesting to start there and maybe explain that a little bit to my non-runner listeners. What is the central governor theory?
Sure. So, I mean, I guess the sort of potted history that I would give is that in the 20th century, physiologists made a ton of progress in understanding the human body as a machine. Mm. And so, you know, just like you, if you want to understand how far a car is going to go or how fast a car can go, you need to understand, you know, how its brakes work, where its fuel tank is, and you know, various other things. If I try and say anything in more detail, I'll reveal that I don't know much about car engines. But anyway, the car is the sort of, it's nothing but the sum of its constituent parts. And for a human, you can say there's all these things that you can talk about, like VO2 max, which is essentially the maximum rate at which you can deliver oxygen through your lungs into your bloodstream, into your muscles. And there's things like lactate threshold and there's fuel economy, which is the same as the fuel economy of a car. And you can come up with these, you can write down equations that say, oh, well, if you know the VO2 max and the lactate threshold and the fuel economy of a given person, you can calculate how fast they can run a marathon. And as you learn, as physiologists learned a ton about these physiological factors that basically determine the physical limits of humans in various contexts. The problem was that they're in some senses they're very powerful, and this knowledge was very impressive, and they really understood a lot about how humans work. But the problem is you could never use that information to predict who would actually win a race. You could spend a week doing measurements of someone of people in a laboratory, and you still wouldn't know which of them is going to actually win when you send them out into the wild. And so it was in the 1990s that a guy named Tim Noakes, who's a very prominent and very, very controversial researcher in South Africa, he proposed an idea that came to be known as the central governor theory. And his point was basically that you can't talk about human limits or about the physical limits of humans without incorporating the brain into that model. So any model that ends at the neck is going to be incomplete. Anyone who's, you know, run a race or pushed their limits in any way intuitively understands this, that, you know, when you, you know, if you go and run a race or push yourself in any challenge, you know that there's these moments of decision, of struggle that are going on that aren't reflected in any sort of calculations of oxygen transport. So anyway, Noakes's theory was essentially that you can never really push to the absolute outer limits of your physical capacity. You can never get the gas pedal all the way down to the floor, that your brain intervenes for your own protection. And the reason it intervenes, that sort of idea has evolved and gone back and forth over the years. You know, it's either for some sort of immediate reason that if you push too hard, you won't be able to, you know, if you push your muscles too hard, then you won't be able to get enough oxygen to your brain or to your heart, and you'll die or whatever. Or there's evolutionary reasons that, you know, generations ago on the savannah chasing the antelopes, the people who were willing to just keep on pushing and pushing and pushing till they keeled over, they didn't make it back to the campfire to pass on their genes. So we have this sort of very difficult to override behaviors that make it hard for us to push right to our limits. And in a sense that you can think of that as a balancing of the risk and reward of, you know, should I keep pushing to try and get more calories, or should I conserve the calories that I have? So anyway, the sum up of the central governor theory is that it was a really controversial and powerful idea that the brain is in charge. Now, in the years since the 90s, that idea has been challenged, and there's other theories and other ideas and various evolutions of the theories, and all of that is, all of these sort of subsequent developments are interesting, but in some ways they all stem from this initial challenge in the 90s by Tim Noakes. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for really shaking up the field of exercise physiology.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the simple version of it is Jens Voigt's "Shut Up Legs." That's how I think of it in a very, very simple sense, but that might be totally off.
Yeah. I mean, and then that's a powerful way of thinking about it. But I guess what Noakes would say is that Jens Voigt can say "shut up legs" as much as he wants, but ultimately the brain's voluntary orders are never going to be the last word. That there's some, someone's pulling the marionette strings, or not someone. This gets into a philosophical debate as to whether, saying there's a central governor, one of the critiques is all you're doing is delegating the decisions to some imaginary homunculus in your brain. There's not someone making the decision, but there's some, ultimately, it's not your decision as to whether you can push to your limits.
Right. Can we talk a little bit about So I think building on from Tim Noakes's work, you go into some detail of a guy by the name of Samuel Marcora, if I've pronounced that right.
Yes, that's correct.
And he gets into this thing about the perception of effort, and I found that really fascinating. When I train, as a runner and a cyclist, I'll use my heart rate monitor, and I'll use a power meter. And, I get this sort of sense, sometimes it's very helpful because on a climb, I can look at my power numbers and I can say, I can, go faster or hold this or whatever. But you do get a little desensitized to this sort of sensation of, the perception of effort and trying to play with that. It might be interesting. I think it would be very interesting if you explained Mark Hoare's work a little bit as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Samuel Marcora is an Italian researcher. He was at the University of Kent for many years. He's just gone back to Italy due to the current situation in Britain. So he's been, I think, the most interesting one to push along the ideas of trying to answer the question of how or what exactly is happening in the brain. So it's one thing to say you can't push to your limits. Something always prevents you. But the question is what and how and why. Mm-hmm. And so Marcora's central claim would be, as you said, that your subjective perception of effort really is the master switch that controls everything. So, you know, if you go out for a ride on your bike, then it, and you're pedaling along at a given power output, it feels, it's going to feel difficult. There's going to be some level of difficulty. And if some passing researcher asks you, hey, by the way, on a scale of 6 to 20, or on a scale of 1 to 10, there are different scales, how hard are you pushing? And you might say, well, I'm pushing 7 out of 10. Then that just seems like an arbitrary number that you've pulled out of your elbow, let's say, that I'm pushing about 7 out of 10. And then if you keep going at that pace, eventually the researcher comes back and says, how hard are you pushing now? And you'd say, well, 8 out of 10. And then later it would be 9 out of 10. And then eventually you get to the point where trying to sustain that power, you'd say, oh, this is 10 out of 10. And at the point you say that, the researcher knows that you're going to stop. You're done. You're not going to be able to continue. Now, that may seem sort of tautological that, you know, you're defining effort as the maximum effort as the point where you stop. But it's actually a really sort of, it's such a simple insight, and yet it's actually powerful. You stop when the effort is no longer tolerable. And Marcora's claim is that this isn't just a sort of coincidence. This is fundamentally what governs our effort, that you, your brain is integrating all the things that we try to measure, all the thing, you know, it could be core temperature, lactate levels, breathing rate, heart rate, all these things. Your brain is integrating all the possible signals, and it's using that to create a sense of how hard it is. And when it gets harder than you're capable of tolerating, that's it. You're done. And so when you stop, not because your heart rate has reached some intolerable maximum or because your breathing is, you know, because you don't have enough oxygen. In every case where someone falls off the back of the treadmill or whatever, if you do the measurements, you find that none of their physiological measures were actually at maximum. You reach exhaustion when your heart rate is below max, when your breathing is below max. The one thing that is reliably maxed out when you say, that's it, I can't keep going, is your subjective perception of effort. So that's the fundamentals of Marcora's idea, is that it's all about effort. And that means that there's a disconnect between this master switch, which is subjective perception of effort, and the physiology of what's going on in your muscles. That means there are things like sports psychology techniques that can change your perception of effort and enhance your performance independent of what's going on in the muscles. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a powerful, practical kind of theory too.
Yeah, you can then, as you say, change the perception of your effort, and it could enhance performance, which in some ways perhaps is you inadvertently tricked your own brain in that race.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, there's some simple examples of that. The simplest is a cup of coffee. That caffeine is a performance enhancer in almost every athletic pursuit. It's the one with the most evidence behind it. And there've been lots of theories over the years as to why caffeine, does it change your fatty acid metabolism, or is it a stimulant? And the current theory is that it actually interferes with the buildup of a chemical in the brain called adenosine that's associated with your perception of effort. So caffeine makes you be able to do more because it just feels easier. Whatever you're doing at a given level of effort feels a little bit easier, so you can keep going longer. But then there's other, like one of Marcora's sort of most surprising to me, at least, experiments was he had cyclists doing an endurance test while flashing pictures of smiling faces or frowning faces on the wall.
Yeah, this was interesting.
Yeah, and these pictures were just up for 16 milliseconds at a time, so you can't perceive them consciously. You don't even know there's faces on the wall, but you're subconsciously perceiving them, and it's sort of changing your general sense of well-being. You're seeing the smiling faces, you're feeling a little better. You're seeing the frowning faces, you're feeling a little more negative. And that changes, essentially, these cyclists are asking themselves, can I keep pedaling for another, 10 seconds? Can I keep going? And if they're feeling a little better about the world, they're just that tiny bit more likely to say yes. And so in that study, he found that when there were smiling faces subliminally flashing on the wall, the cyclists lasted 12% longer in this endurance test than frowning faces. And again, that's just manipulating their sense of effort, not their actual muscles or anything.
That's so fascinating. And it wasn't the same thing in running, the thing about, I might be getting this entirely wrong, but running as if you were holding a pencil in your mouth or something like this to mimic the smiling muscles or something along those lines.
Yeah, there's some famous experiments that go back to the 1980s where actually the original experiment involved rating how funny a Far Side cartoon was. Okay. And the subjects were asked to either hold the pencil in their mouth like a dog holds a bone, sort of crossways, or as if they're sucking on a straw. And that's not smiling or frowning, but it activates some of the same muscles as smiling if you're holding it like a bone, like a dog holding a bone, or frowning if you're like a straw. And they rated the cartoons more funny, as funnier, when they were activating their smiling muscles without any knowledge of what the experiment was about. And I should, in mentioning that experiment, I should say that it, as part of the big sort of rethink of social psychology in the last few years, there's been some replication attempts of this effect, which haven't actually confirmed that it works. But so it's a controversial finding, but I think there's pretty strong evidence of this is what's called the facial feedback hypothesis, that mm-hmm. that smiling makes you happy, you know, conversely to the idea that you smile when you're happy.
Right. I've never been a huge smiler, but when people have said the smile, it makes you feel better. And I suppose there's some truth to it.
Well, I have to admit that I'm not a huge smiler either. But what I found is just when I'm out running, it's just not going to happen that I'm going to be running around with a big smile on my face. But I've started to be aware that when things get hard, I have a habit of really sort of contorting my face into this grimace of absolute agony. Huh. And as I've become aware of that, and I've sort of read this research, I thought, well, what if I just at least relax my face and stop looking as if someone is like digging flaming bamboo under my fingernails? And it's amazing that like it makes a difference. Hmm. All of a sudden, I'm going along, you know, face contorted. I'm pushing as hard as I can. Then I'm like, okay, let's relax the face. Like, oh, I'm still running at the same pace. And now I no longer feel like I'm so, there's degrees and there's different ways of approaching this, but it's not that everyone needs to run around looking as if they're, you know, they've just heard the funniest joke ever. But being aware of how the people around you and even just your own sort of self-presentation, how it influences, you know, you start to believe your own hype. And if you're running around like, oh, I'm doing the hardest thing ever, then you start to believe that and think, man, this is really hard.
Hmm. What's the role, do you think, of working or having, so I'm just thinking more around the 4-minute mile and Bannister, but also the Breaking 2 project, and what may occur when, you know, others, if and when, probably when we have a sub-2-hour marathon, will that lead to other runners being able to do the same thing because somewhere that's broken a barrier, mental barrier?
Yeah, I think there's some reality to that. I think there's not as much reality to that as you might find in some self-help books. I found it when I was researching the book. I found this one amazing book where it's like breathlessly reporting, you know, and after Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, 300 people broke it the next year. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, that's just not true. Like four mm-hmm. people broke, or one person broke it in the next year and four people the year after, or something like that. So I think these sort of psychological barriers are real in the sense that your self-belief is important in terms of what you set out to do and how you set out to prepare for tasks. So for example, if you want to run a sub-2-hour marathon, you have to run the first half pretty close to 1 hour. And, you know, until recently, the thought of that was preposterous. So no one would even put themselves in a position to try or to train at those paces. Now, it's not simply, oh, well, now we see someone do it, I'm going to go do it, it's easy. But once, in a sense, I think self-belief and the willingness to put yourself out there for an audacious goal, it's a lot easier to do that when you know it's possible, or when you know that something very close to that is possible. It's a lot harder to put yourself. So maybe one of the sort of bodies of evidence that I think speaks to this from a different angle is if you look at the records for things like horse racing and dog racing, which have been kept for, in some cases, for centuries, and there's a ton of money in horse racing and to a lesser extent in dog racing. So when we talk about why are humans still getting faster and faster year by year in various races, well, it's like, well, there's lots of money at stake. There's lots of advances in technology and understanding. Believe me, anything we can learn about making animals go faster is being applied to horses and dogs too. But if you look at the historical records, the records in those sports have at the sort of big races like the Kentucky Derby have more or less stagnated since the 1950s to some, maybe a little later, but horses and dogs aren't getting a lot faster. Humans keep getting faster. And I would argue it's related to this idea of, if you're a horse or a dog, all you can do is race in that moment. You're seeing how fast you can go and you're trying to beat the animals around you. If you're a human, you're not just racing against that moment. You're racing against your knowledge of what else has been done. And if you're the best runner on the planet, you're thinking, well, somebody else ran a 400 mile, I bet I can run 359. And so you're setting your goals based on what other people have done. And that's why I think when these barriers fall, there is sometimes a little, let's not call it a flood, but there's an increase in, you get an uptick in other people following people through a barrier. And I think that's because once you know someone has done something, you can set your own goals and guide your own training with that in mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good word that you used, uptick versus some sort of transformational, a revolution of abilities.
Yeah, and it's because, some economists in the States at University of Chicago and a few other places analyzed something like 9 million marathon times and to see if there were patterns in the times people ran. And what they found is there were, if you look at round number barriers, like 3 hours and 4 hours, but also 3:30 and even like 3:10, 3:20, there's always slightly more people than you expect right under the barrier and slightly fewer right over the barrier. And this suggests that you talk to people at the finish of a marathon, they're like, yeah, I was going as hard as I could. But the people who suddenly realize with a minute to go that they're within shouting distance, that if they just pick it up a little bit, they're going to be able to get under that big goal, they find that they can dig a little deeper. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't the case, like you said, so getting back to this point, that it's not like there's some radical transformation. It's just that you look at the stats and it's like, yeah, people just, there's enough people, and not everyone finds this, but on average, statistically, when there's big barriers at stake, people find that they're able to push a little harder, and that sort of just alters the distribution a little bit, but doesn't, like you said, mm-hmm. it doesn't turn you, it doesn't give you wings and doesn't give you magic.
Right. And in spite of all the self-help stuff that's out there. But something that you discuss in the book and was reminded of is this idea of this U-shaped pacing curve. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about pacing a little bit, because I think it ties into risk and uncertainty and some of the themes that we cover on the show. But I think you describe that most races, the pacing curve kind of goes, it looks like a U. And I could be getting that wrong, I feel like that's the case. When I look at my Strava or whatever, when I look at the curve, it looks like that. When I read your book and I went back and looked at some of my races, that does look like that.
Yeah, I think it turns out to be a surprisingly kind of universal truth, and one that, like you said, I think it ties into ideas of risk and how you deal with differing amounts of risk, and it's sort of a fundamental sort of statement about the nature of limits. So anyway, the way I would explain this is, look, if you go down to the local park run or 5K or whatever and stand near the finish line, you'll see a lot of people sort of turn the final corner, see the finish line, and their eyes kind of light up and they start sprinting. And the assumption you make there is like, these people, they don't know how to pace themselves. Like, why are they sprinting at the end? They should have, spread their efforts out evenly, like we all know is the best way to do it. But what it turns out is when you actually look at the data, even the best runners in the world run like that. Maybe not in quite as pronounced a way as the sort of 8-year-old at the local 5K. But there was a great analysis from Tim Noakes' group, actually, that found world record intermediate split data for basically going back to the early 1900s. So for every world record set in the modern era at distances like the mile, 5,000 meters, 10,000 meters, and they analyzed these splits, and what they found, it was nearly universal that you had, as you said, this sort of U shape. You start out fast, then you slow down a little bit, settle into a sustainable pace, which you sustain till very close to the end, let's say the last kilometer or so. And then as you get closer to the finish, you're able to speed up again. And you ask this person at 8K, how are you going as hard as you can? And you say, yes, I'm pushing as hard as I can. But somehow the sight of the finish allows you to speed up. And so this is sort of cited. Tim Noakes was cited, started out by citing this as evidence for this idea of a central governor, that your central governor is trying to protect you from, homeostatic catastrophe of pushing yourself too hard. And once you know that the finish line is there, your central governor is able to say, okay, the danger is passing. You're going to stop soon. So now you can sort of take off the brakes and go as hard as you want. And so that's a sort of, a hand-waving explanation of what's going on. But ultimately, I think people think of it mostly as a psychological thing now. And there's a pacing is a sort of a big area of research, and it's very complicated because it's affected by all sorts of things, by the environment, by your preparation and the distance, and whether you're responding to athletes around you like competitors. But by and large, one of the theories that's emerged in the last year, a few years, is called the hazard score, which is an idea. I think it was a guy named Joost de Koning. I might have that wrong, but some Dutch researchers developed this idea. And basically, what the hazard score is they say at any given moment in a race, you're conscious of a couple of things, or two main things. One is, how hard am I working right now? What's my subjective sense of effort, as we went back to this sort of master switch? And the second key thing is, how much longer do I have to go? Because how much longer you have to go is going to determine how much risk you're in of, the catastrophe that you're trying to avoid in this case is having to stop, or being unable to continue. And so early in the race, if you're in a 10K race, if you're 2K into the race, you're probably not working that hard unless you've really screwed things up. Like, you're not physiologically, you're not pushing that hard 2K into a 10K race, but you've got a long way to go. So your hazard score is pretty high. Towards the end of the race, you're working really, really hard. And
right.
But you've got almost nothing. Your hazard score is very low. You're not worried. You don't care how hard you're working.
Right.
Because the risk of blowing up and not being able to finish is low. The risk of suffering a lot is pretty low, because there's only so much suffering you can do in the last minute or two of a race. In the middle of the race is where things get interesting, because then you're balancing. You have a reasonable. It's getting pretty hard by the time you're at the 5K mark, and you also still have quite a ways to go. And so when they try and look at, okay, well, let's quantify this hazard score, subjective sense of effort multiplied by percentage of the race that still has to go. And what they find is it's sort of the opposite of the U-shaped curve. You have this sort of upside down dome shape where the hazard score is highest in a lot of cases in around the middle of the race, early middle of the race, there's still a lot of unknowns about how the middle of the race is going to go, and so that's forcing you to be a little bit more conservative, because you don't want to push too hard too early. And so the point of this hazard score is, what they say is, if you want to predict whether a runner is going to speed up or slow down at any given point of the race, look at their hazard score, and you'll find that. So it's not they don't speed up and slow down when it's easy, because otherwise 2K into the race you'd be speeding up madly because it still feels easy. But if you look at the hazard score, so the product of how hard they're pushing plus the fraction of times the fraction of the race available, that predicts whether they're going to speed up or slow down. And so you're managing your risk on a constantly sliding scale. By the closer you get to the finish, the harder it gets, but the more you're willing to take risks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really fascinating. And I guess at a level that sort of that risk is, I guess we're pre-programmed from an evolutionary point of view to protect downside. So to deal with, we're more risk averse when we suffer more from losses, it's been shown, than we do, gain pleasure from gains. And that's all evolutionary. And I suppose there's something to a lot of this is, I don't know if, maybe we can talk a little bit about brain hacking, this at some level, the brain perhaps is being overprotective.
Yeah, I think so. And just to sort of echo what you're saying there, I think what the U-shaped pacing curve tells us is that we're more afraid of overdoing it than of underperforming. Mm. So we don't want to, there's, for some reason, there's an asymmetry in, because otherwise we would pace perfectly evenly, and sometimes we would blow up, and sometimes we would, sometimes we would have to slow down at the end, and sometimes we would have to speed up at, and sometimes we'd be able to speed up at the end. But the fact that we always are fundamentally conservative, I think, is tied into what you're saying about loss aversion, maybe in some way, and not wanting to kind of lose, not wanting to be in a situation where late in the race we lose what we thought mm-hmm. we had.
I suppose at a certain level, the brain doesn't distinguish, or the mind and the body don't distinguish between a race, because that's just a human construct, just something we've invented, versus a real life and death struggle.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily in the case that in the sense that the lion is about to leap out of behind mm-hmm. a tree and eat us, but in a sense, probably the best model for racing is foraging or hunting back in the day, or in our evolutionary past, and so it's maybe not do I live or die today, but it's am I making the decisions that are going to enable me to have enough calories to live for the next few days or week or whatever the case may be. So I think we're fundamentally responding to those same cues as if this was a sort of energy optimization challenge in the long distant past.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, somewhere we're still in the Savannah.
Yeah, Savannah. We'd like to be in Havana. Unfortunately, yeah. We're in the Savannah.
yeah, I think that makes sense. The final chapter on belief really plays into this, and I was fascinated by this. The Kenyan runner who just kind of went for it, and versus the Western runners who so the Kenyan runner we just talked about, the U-shaped curve and protection and everything, but there's an attitude amongst Kenyan runners, I suppose non-Western runners, that says, well, I'm just going to go for it if I have a chance here to get on the podium or whatever. And if I blow up, I blow up.
That's super interesting. We should preface this discussion with the fact that, all these sorts of generalities are nothing but generalities.
Right.
And there's lots of exceptions. But
fair enough.
For anyone who's, lived in the endurance world or done a lot of racing at the top level, the pattern is pretty clear. Like, you go to big road races, and I competed for quite a while at the elite level, but let's say the sub-elite level, going to big road races, and you'd have a couple dozen runners in the elite section of the field, and half of them might be Kenyan, and every one of the Kenyan runners would go out with the leaders and just run with the leaders as long as they could until they blew up, and sometimes they blew up quite badly, and then every one of the Canadian and American and British runners and Romanian runners and all sorts of seemingly from everywhere else would be running this race, which was more about like, well, this is what I think I can do, therefore I'm going to try and optimize my performance by running at the right pace throughout the race. And as I sort of talk about in the book, when in my days as an athlete, I sort of thought, well, I'm being the smart one here. I'm the one who's running a high percentage of consistent racing. I never get to the 7K mark of a 10K and just absolutely explode in flames and have to be like, carried back to the finish line. I always am reasonably consistent. And meanwhile, some of these Kenyan runners, sometimes they'd have a great day and they'd be up near the front, and sometimes they would absolutely hit the wall. And in hindsight, as I was writing this book and thinking about this more carefully, I was sort of like, gosh, I think they were right. I think they were right, because who cares if they ran, 20 races in a season, and if 15 of those races were stinkers, but five of them, they were finishing in the top three, running amazing times and, making money from finishing in the top three. Like a lot of these races, there might be 24 or 25 elite runners, and there might be money for the top three or the top five. So, you can see where some of this comes from incentivization for the Kenyan runners. A lot of them come from, mm-hmm. really, really serious poverty. They don't care if they set a personal best and come fifth. They need to be in the top three and get some money to send home to support their family. So they would rather have three top threes and 17 did not finishes. And even from the sake of like looking back now, my own athletic career 20 years ago, I'm not like, boy, I'm really proud that I was consistent and never finished lower than seventh in my race. I would much rather be able to say, I won that race.
Right. Or,
here was my best time, not here was my average time over the course of 10 races. So, it becomes a question of, I mean, there's a question of incentives. Why are you running? Are you running for self-actualization or are you running to make money? There's a question of self-belief. Do you believe that even if you go out with the leaders and blow up today, next week you might have a better chance? And my impression was that one of the preconditions for Kenyan runners running the way they were able to run is that they had to be able to shake off, getting their doors blown off and not take that as that proves they're not good enough. Instead, they could dust themselves off and say, today wasn't my day, but next week could be my week. Whereas I would get beaten and think, man, those guys are way better than me. I can't do it. So my place in the universe is fixed.
Yeah, that's interesting. The whole incentive, because podium would be life transforming for all elite runners or any runner in a major race, but certainly for those that are from a poor background.
Yeah, I mean, I had a chance 12 or 13 years ago to spend some time with a runner named Joseph Duritu. I was working for a newspaper in Ottawa, and so I pitched to them as like, hey, we know the Ottawa Marathon is coming up. You know that some Kenyan runners are going to come here and they're going to win the race, but nobody really knows anything about them. Why don't you send me to spend some time with one of them, a guy who's won in years past, and figure out who he is and what his story is? And so I really got a chance to spend some time with this guy, and it was just amazing. You know, we sort of know the cliches about they're coming from poverty and money can be transforming, but just to hear in specific detail about this guy's life and how he wasn't a runner. He was working as a manual laborer. He heard on the radio one year that a Kenyan guy named Eric Wainaina had come third at the Olympics. And he thought, man, I used to race that guy when I was in elementary school. I bet I'm as fast as him. So he quits his job and goes and spends 3 years training as a runner he hasn't been running since he was a kid. He spends 3 years. So he's got no money. His parents are taking care of his kids. He's living in a grass hut. After 3 years, finally he gets, he can't get to any races. He doesn't have the money for a plane ticket or anything. An agent hears, a guy he knows tells a guy he knows that this guy might be ready to travel overseas. So a guy buys him a plane ticket. An agent buys him a plane ticket. He comes over to Canada, runs a bunch of races, goes home after 8 weeks with $400. Now, if you're he's living on the floor of an apartment with 16 Kenyan runners, for someone like me who was in Canada racing these races, I had to have a job. It's not sustainable for me. But for them, they lived cheap enough. He went home with $400, and that was life transforming. They bought the first ever cow for milking in their family, and the next year he came back with $1,000 and was able to buy basically a farm. And so it's like,
absolutely.
You realize it's like, okay, that's a different level of life transformation. And this guy is on the sort of fourth tier of runners. He's not winning the Olympics.
Yep.
He's winning the Joe's 5K in a small town in Ontario. And he's racing twice a weekend, every weekend for 8 weeks. So anyways, a bit of a digression, but it's
super interesting.
World.
And then on the flip side, I was thinking about, there's no shame in blowing up if you're a Kenyan, whereas perhaps there might be if you're an elite runner. And it reminds me of a couple of things. One was something that I heard Malcolm Gladwell talk about on his podcast, and he obviously wrote the Forward to Endure, and that was about when to pull the goalie in hockey.
Oh, yeah.
That you should, that teams should do that way earlier than they do, but they don't, because once you start doing that, then, 3-0 becomes 4-5-6-7-8, and it looks bad. But if you're losing, you're losing. And it's similar to I spoke to Annie Duke, who's this World Series of Poker champion, and she wrote a book on decision making and thinking in bets and the social pressures of doing something unconventional, even though it's the smart thing to do, is quite acute. So
yeah, that's a great analogy. I mean, to the pulling the goalie, it's like, why don't you pull the goalie? It has nothing to do with optimizing your chances in the game, and everything to do with
how it looks.
Exactly. Not sort of embarrassing yourself or whatever.
Yeah. And so I suppose from a downside perspective, you know, Kenyan runners will just say, well, you know, I blew up and that, you know, oh yeah, you did too. So did I last week or whatever.
Yeah. And that's the sort of thing, like in that 15 years ago, when I was running these races, I would sort of be snickering behind my hand, like as that, you know, I would pat 12 Kenyan runners would go out way in front of me and I would catch half of them. And as the ones I'd passed, I'd think, you know, that guy was an idiot. Why was he a minute in front of me at the halfway mark? And then I blew his doors off in the last half. It's like, but next week he blew my doors off. And I was, you know, next week he was first and last week he was 20th. I was 12th both times. And it's better to be first once and 20th the other time than to be 12th over and over and over again. But I didn't kind of clue into that.
Yeah. And it's the same in all kinds of sport, right? There's going for it on fourth down in American football, third down, I guess, in Canadian football. And that, again, more teams should do it than they do. And but they don't because of perception and all that stuff. So it's super, super interesting. Go ahead.
I was just going to say this is the rise of the era of analytics has started to change that in some of the team sports where you can see it's like, no, really, like the onside kick really does help or whatever whatever the case may be. That doesn't convince everybody, right? Like you can show people stats, all day long and they might still say, yeah, but I still don't want to do that. So it's interesting to see that culture clash, and how it sort of manifests in different sports, arenas.
Yeah. And it's not because it's not the done thing. And in cycling, I know that one of the frustrations of purists in Europe is how, you know, the power meter and not just, you know, the heart rate monitor has been around for decades and decades, but the power meter in particular has diluted, and all these numbers has really, you know, diluted the spectator experience in, say, the Tour de France, and why cyclists like, you know, Marco Pantani was so revered that they would just do these wild attacks at these inopportune moments, and this, it wouldn't make any sense. And now you've got, you know, if you look at the Tour de France, you look at Chris Froome, he's always looking down. He's looking down at his numbers. He knows he can go and sustain something or not. And so you don't see these sort of these crazy attacks, although in the Giro d'Italia last year, Chris Froome did that. But it dilutes the spectator experience because the unpredictability, the uncertainty, just it goes away.
Yeah, and I'll admit, I'm at heart, I'm a traditionalist, and in the sense that, so a lot of my day job is writing about, you know, new sports technologies and like how effective is a power meter at regulating your effort, and you know, what metrics can we look at that will optimize your knowledge of whether you can go harder or not. And my general thesis in a lot of when I write about these things is that, and I'm always eager to see studies that sort of suggest that, you know what, perceived effort is still more powerful. No external device is yet better than, the sense of an elite athlete of when they can hold them and when they have to, you know, fold them or whatever. But like a lot of people, I love the idea of the sort of intuitive, just going for it, laying the cards on the table. But the truth is, it does seem like that era is kind of passing. That the external monitoring, the technology is getting so good that it's certainly much harder to surprise someone in the Tour de France to do something that the power meter didn't predict you could do anyway.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know what the sport will do. They've tried all kinds of things to try and make it more exciting, but it is. And the thing about banning power meters, their proposals are about banning power meters during races, which, who knows what will come about. It makes it interesting. I did want to, I know you have a whole bunch of chapters on limits, whether that's pain, muscle, food, etc. And we don't have a lot of time to time to cover any of these in any depth, but we haven't really talked about some of the physical limits. And I don't know if you could maybe share one or two thoughts on, I guess, any of those things, the sort of, whether it's food, water, oxygen, that might be of interest from your book.
Sure. I guess, like, So as I said, the sort of general thesis of the book was, it's like, you're, what feels like a physical limit is the strings are being pulled by your brain, but it's, you know, the way in which that happens and the balance is different for every type of, you know, whether it's because you feel like you're dehydrated or you're running out of fuel or you're in pain or your muscles don't work anymore. The balance is different in each one. But one of the ones that I think was really sort of representative to me of this sort of interplay and also the one that was most surprising to me was the stuff on oxygen. So for an endurance athlete, oxygen feels like the most obvious limitation, right? You start running, you start cycling, you're breathing hard, and you feel like at a certain point, if you're going hard enough, you feel like you just can't breathe in enough, and you can't get enough oxygen, and that's holding you back. And so, to try and understand this, I was like, well, okay, so are you really running out of oxygen? It's like what is the exact limit here? And so I ended up looking into the free diving literature, which was a world that I really knew nothing about before this. And I'd sort of heard the vague secondhand stories of, you know, David Blaine held his breath for this long, or people die this long. I kind of thought they were exaggerated. There's a trick, there's something. But so I looked into it and it's like, no, the world record for holding your breath with no trick. So David Blaine did this trick where he pre-breathes oxygen and then holds his breath, and he held his breath for 17 minutes. Take away those sorts of tricks where you're breathing pure oxygen. Just say, it's like you're walking down the street one day, someone says, okay, how long can you hold your breath? The world record is, and for everyone listening here, before I tell you, just put a number in your head. What do you think the record for holding your breath is? Now, the answer is 11 minutes and 35 seconds, which to me was just nuts. Like, again, no tricks here. There's not some sort of secret. It's just like people learn to hold their breath. And this isn't someone who's like 11 foot two with enormous lungs. This is just an ordinary, you know, probably someone who has some talent for it in some way, but basically it's a trained attribute. And so the key thing here is to understand, okay, so then what happens? Well, how come I can't hold my breath for anywhere near that long? And I had a chance to chat, actually after the book came out, I had a chance to chat with a guy named Brandon Hendrickson, who's the North American record holder for breath holding with, I think it was 8 minutes and 35 seconds. And I asked him to sort of take me through the phases of his breath hold. And, you know, what he said is for him, the first 4 minutes are relatively easy. And then what starts is called the struggle phase. And this is something that for me would hit after maybe a minute and a half. But it's like at that point, what your body is responding to is rising levels of carbon dioxide, because you have an alarm system. Instead of your body just sort of oxygen runs out and you die, you have, okay, carbon dioxide levels are rising, and that warns you that oxygen is an issue. So once your carbon dioxide levels get to a certain point, your body just kind of takes over and thinks something weird is happening. We're going to just breathe automatically without waiting for the instructions. And so your diaphragm starts to convulse, basically. It starts trying to force a breath. And for me, that's the end, right? Like as soon as if my diaphragm convulses and trying to force me to breathe, I breathe. Free divers learn to suppress that so that their diaphragms keep convulsing, but they don't breathe. And so these are called involuntary breathing movements, and they can have like 100 of them in a single breath hold. That's just over and over again, the diaphragm is trying to force them to breathe. So this guy, Brandon, he's like, yeah, that starts for him sometime between 4 and 5 minutes. That's when his body thinks he's completely done and tries to take over. But he's able to override that and wait till 8.5 minutes. And at that point, there's a lot of interesting research on these breath hold divers because it's a great way of trying to understand what the body's true limits are. Free divers can hold their breath till they really are running out of oxygen. So 8 minutes and 35 seconds, Brandon Hendricks, you can see the video of his breath hold. His coach taps him on the shoulder. At first, he doesn't respond because he's in this another world. But eventually, he's like, oh yeah, takes his head out of the water because he's doing it face down in the water to prevent cheating. He takes his head out of the water, and that's the end of the breath hold. At that point, there was no more signal telling him that he was about to run out of oxygen. This was just where they had decided they'd better get him up because they didn't know if he could go any farther than that. And if he'd kept holding, he would have passed out. And if he was on a free dive, if he was 30 meters underwater, he would have died if he passed out at that point. So the warning system kicks in 4 minutes and he held still 8 minutes. And to me, that's a sort of symbol of that there is this sort of the warning system is cautious. It kicks in early. And of course you can't make a perfect analogy between, well, so if there's 50% safety margin in breath holding, that means I can run twice as fast in a marathon if I really push to my limits. That's not obviously the way it works. But what it says to me, because one thing people often ask is like, okay, if we have this central governor that's holding us back for our own good, isn't that sort of dangerous to push past it? Aren't we going to push ourselves to death? And I would say it's not that there's zero danger. There are some situations, especially in like hot weather, if you're pushing yourself really hard in hot weather, the brain's sort of calculations don't seem to be as reliable as they could be. And sometimes people get in serious trouble and get heat stroke. But for the most part, we're a long way from true physical limits. And it's very, very hard to, you know, if you learn to push a little farther, to hold, just kind of hold your finger in the candle flame a little bit longer, you're not getting anywhere near true physical limits. You're just pushing a little closer.
That's fascinating. That's really, yeah, that you're right. The system is probably overly cautious.
For good reason.
For good reason, exactly. what do you make of, have you looked at the Wim Hof method at all, for, you know, breathing wise and things like ice baths? You talked about, you mentioned ice baths at the start, but what do you make of all that and cold showers and, you know, all that stuff and those techniques?
So look, I'm not an expert in Wim Hof, so take my opinions with a grain of salt. I started reading, one of the books on the Wim Hof method, What Doesn't Kill You, and I got frustrated with a few things about halfway through. I didn't end up finishing it. I don't have any doubt that Wim Hof can do remarkable things, and I don't have any doubt that I don't really have any doubt that he can teach other people to do remarkable things. I would maybe quibble with some of the mechanisms that he attributes this to. You know, the idea that he can sort of with his mind turn on his brown fat cells to start generating heat. I mean, I think the human body and mind are very adaptable and can, you know, if you challenge them, you will discover that you're capable of way, way more than you thought, whether it's tolerating cold or, you know, running a marathon you know, in many other contexts of life, you can deal with a lot if you're sufficiently motivated and put yourself through in challenging situations. So I think Wim Hof taught a lot of people or helped encourage a lot of people to push themselves in interesting ways that's had interesting effects. And I don't want to dismiss the physiology. So that's psychology, I would guess. I think exposing yourself to cold probably has physiological effects too, and causes some adaptations. There is some evidence that persistent exposure to cold, for example, might increase the levels of brown fat in your body. And brown fat is this very metabolically useful tissue that burns a lot of calories and keeps you warm. So there's changes. I guess I'm a little skeptical sometimes of the sort of magical or pseudo magical explanations offered for some of the effects. But I think there's certainly power in some of these approaches.
Okay, that makes sense and sounds perfectly reasonable to me. I did want to just touch on recovery a little bit, perhaps before we wrap up. This is not something that you specifically have a chapter on, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on just the mental side of recovery. Maybe it's that part of that link. I forget which experiment now it was, but when the participants were given a hard math problem or something, and then they were asked to exercise, and it had an effect. And I suppose. I notice in my own training when I have a high level of stress that my physical training isn't as good. Don't know if you have any thoughts on.
Yeah. So two different things that I'll answer separately. First of all, this idea of sort of mental fatigue having an effect on physical performance. This is another area where Samuel Marcora, who we talked about earlier, has done some really interesting research. And so he found 90 minutes of screen time doing a sort of a task that demands focus had a dramatic effect on physical performance when you hop on a bike right after. And this is sort of intuitive, right? Like, as you said, you do a hard day at work, then things aren't going to go, you're not going to have your greatest workout or whatever. But what was remarkable was the size of the effect. What he found is that 90 minutes of screen time had as much of a bad effect on performance as doing 100 drop jumps. And sort of we all know, at least I know, if I do 100 drop jumps, my legs are going to feel trashed. I know I'm not at my best. But we're often sort of unaware of the extent to which being mentally fatigued can influence performance. So I would say being aware of mental fatigue is really important, not just in a sports context, but in sort of all sorts of contexts. If you have an important meeting or if you're writing an exam or whatever the case may be, spending an extra 3 hours studying often is going to be counterproductive, especially if you're stressed out and if you're mm-hmm. cutting short on sleep. You know, if it's an afternoon meeting, going for a half hour walk outside over lunch is probably going to do more for you than trying to cram more facts in, assuming mm-hmm. you've done reasonable preparation, right?
Sure.
Like there's a point at which you do have to, you know, you can't just fake it based on, you know, thinking happy thoughts and so on. But just in the same way that before a marathon, you cut your mileage back. Mm-hmm. You don't run 100 miles the week of the marathon for the most part. You also mentally, you want to give yourself a break to make sure you're sharp, because mental fatigue has a really, really significant effect on your performance, both physical and cognitive. Now, the other sort of angle of that question is recovery. You know, from a sports point of view, probably the simplest answer I can give is there's a new book out published in February by a science journalist named Christy Ashwanden called Good to Go, the I can't remember the subtitle, The Strange Science of Sports Recovery and What It Teaches the Athletes and All of Us or something. Basically, it's an attempt to try and understand this whole world of ice baths, compression garments, anti-inflammatories, and all that stuff, and to look at the science of it. And if I can be so bold as to summarize it in a few sentences, basically the gist is the vast majority of these things probably don't do what we think they do. It doesn't mean they're useless, but they don't, the sort of the magic of like flushing away lactic acid or reducing inflammation probably doesn't have much effect. And in keeping with what you said, what Christy's main conclusion is that the main value of some of these things may be just forcing us to slow down and relax. That stress is stress, whether it's stress from a hard workout or stress from a hard day at work or from, you know, personal situations or whatever. All of that is slowing down recovery in our body. And so sometimes what we need is just a chance to unwind and relax. And if you get that from soaking in an ice tub or then maybe that's as good a place as any. But understanding that one way or another, you need to give your body a chance to recover. It is important.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I don't know how relaxing soaking in an ice tub is for most, but I'm sure for some it's fine.
Yeah, maybe if it gets you off your cell phone, that's what counts. Even if
true. Legs are freezing. True. Well, this is great. I want to be respectful of your time. So I feel like I can talk to you for another couple of hours, but we don't have that. We don't have that amount of time. And but before we go, is there anything that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to cover?
There's nothing that sort of leaps to mind. We covered a lot of interesting topics. There's a billion more, and so there's not one that where I'm thinking, I wish you had brought up how Alex's book is available at fine retailers everywhere.
I was gonna get to that actually. I did have one thing was just in the work that you've done. Was there anything that you felt was transferable, sort of outside of the athletic context? Maybe you talked a little bit about going for walks in nature and this sort of thing, but maybe in a non-athletic or maybe in an organization or just individual.
I do think there are things that are transferable. I'm always a little sort of cautious about trying to too glibly and simply say, smiling works for marathoners, therefore smile at work. But I think there are some general messages about mindset. We talked a little bit about those smiling faces, but there's some interesting research on self-talk and the sort of measurable effects you can get from changing your internal monologue from like, this is really hard, I can't do this, to I'm ready for this, I can do this. And so I think that's 100% transferable. It's always so hard to convey this message without sounding like a self-help book, but there is. For me, as going from what's taken me from a sort of skeptic to someone who's willing to talk about this stuff, is that there's some really interesting research in the sports context that shows how transforming your internal monologue can produce measurable results. And I suspect that is highly transferable to a business environment. Also, we talked about mental fatigue, and I think that's people underestimate the degree to which being cognitively worn down means that they're going to be making worse decisions. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple areas, but like you said, getting out and getting exercise, getting physical activity, doesn't have to be at the gym, but getting out for a walk and getting outside in natural environments, I think, is something that You know, I always sort of roll my eyes when people are talking about walking meetings and things like that, because I have, you know, if it works for you, that's great. But just finding some time to be outside at some point, and to be ideally not outside on a busy traffic jam or anything like that, but getting into a park or something like that, I think can make a big difference.
Yeah, that's all great stuff, and certainly sage advice. Before we go, for my listeners who want to, well, they want to buy Endure, or they want to know more about you and your work, where can they find you, and where can they pick up a copy of Endure?
Yeah, probably the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is sweatscience, all one word. I do have a website, alexhutchinson.net, if you want sort of more details or links to past articles and stuff. But Twitter's where I post sort of all the articles I write and other things I find interesting. And the book Endure should be available more or less everywhere, major bookstores, you know, Amazon, places like that, local independents too, obviously are good to support. So yeah, it should be available more or less anywhere. In the UK, it's now out in paperback. In North America, it's still in hardcover.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's great. Alex, thank you very much once again, and wish you all the best, and I'll certainly keep following you. This was fascinating. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Ben. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise. Bye for now.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. Links are in the show notes as usual. Give Alex a follow, of course, and pick up a copy of Endure. And you can even use your free trial of Audible to get yourself an audio version of the book. Links to that are also in the show notes. And if you are a fan of all things risk, one of the best, quickest, and a free way in which you can support the show is to give us a positive rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've not yet subscribed as well, what are you waiting for? Go to allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, to find all the places in which you can get the show. Finally, we'll be temporarily moving to a one episode every 3 week schedule for a couple of months, but don't worry, it's only temporary. So we'll be back in 3 weeks. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.